Second Canto, Chapter 5, Text Number 17. Ordnance, Tashya, his, Api, Sotamu, Drastu, of the seer, Isheshya, of the controller, Krutas, Tashya, of the one who is over everyone's intelligence, Akilatmana, of the super soul, Shrijam, that which is already created, Shrijami, I do discover, Shrestha created Aham, myself, Ikshaya, my glance over Eva, exactly, Abhichodita, being inspired by him. Tashyapi jastu ishasya. Kutas tashya kilatmana. Sajam sujam sastoham. Eksha vaibo chitolita. Tashyapi jastu ishasya. Kutashasya kilatmane. Sujam sujam shustoham. Ekshaya vabhichodita.
Ekshaya vabhichodita. Tasya pidrasureshasya.
Tasya pidrasureshasya.
Kutashasya kilatmane.
Translation and purport by Sri Vaishnava Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki. Inspired by him only, I discover what is already created by him, Narayana, under his vision as the all-pervading Supersoul. And I also am created by him only. Purport. Even Brahma, the creator of the universe, admits that he is not the actual creator, but is simply inspired by Lord Narayana and therefore creates under his superintendence those things already created by him, the Supersoul of all living entities. Two identities of soul, the Supersoul and the individual soul, are admitted to be in the living entity, even by the greatest authority of the universe. The Supersoul is the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead, whereas the individual soul is the eternal servant of the Lord. The Lord inspires the individual soul to create what is already created by the Lord, and by the goodwill of the Lord, a discoverer of something in the world is accredited as the discoverer. It is said that Columbus discovered the Western Hemisphere. But actually, the tract of land was not created by Columbus. The vast tract of land was already there by the omnipotency of the Lord. And Columbus, by dint of his past service unto the Lord, was blessed with credit of discovering America. You didn't know Columbus had some past activities recognized by the Lord, did you? Similarly, no one can create anything without the sanction of the Lord. since everyone sees according to his ability. This ability is also awarded by the Lord according to one's willingness to render service unto the Lord. One must therefore be voluntarily willing to render service unto the Lord, and thus the Lord will empower the doer in proportion to his surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord. Lord Brahma is a great devotee of the Lord. Therefore, he has been empowered or inspired by the Lord to create such a universe as the one manifest before us. The Lord also inspired Arjuna to fight in the battlefield, in the field of Kurukshetra, as follows. Tasmatam utistavyashpavas jitva satun bhuntva rajasuridam mayavate mihata purvameva namitamatam bhavasavasachin. Bhagavad Gita 11:33. The battle of Kurukshetra and other battle, and any other battle at any place or at any time, is made by the will of the Lord. For no one can arrange such mass annihilation without the sanction of the Lord. The party of Duryodhana insulted Draupadi, a great devotee of the Lord, of Krishna, and she appealed to the Lord as well as to all the silent observers of this unwarranted insult. Arjuna was then advised by the Lord to fight and take credit. Otherwise, the party of Duryodhana would be killed anyway by the will of the Lord. So Arjuna was advised just to become the agent and take credit for killing great generals like Bhishma and Karna. In the Vedic writings, such as the Katha Upanishad, the Lord is described as Sarvabhuta Antaratma, or the personality of Godhead who resides in everyone's body, and who directs everything for one who is a soul surrendered unto him. Those who are not surrendered souls are put under the care of material nature. Ramayana Sarvabhutanam Yantarudranam Mayaya. Therefore, they are allowed to do things on their own account and suffer the consequences themselves. Devotees like Brahma and Arjuna do not do anything on their own account, but as fully surrendered souls, they always await indications from the Lord. Therefore, the attempt to do something which appears very wonderful, to ordinary vision. One of the Lord's names is Arupama, or one whose actions are very wonderful and are beyond the imagination of a living being. So the actions of his devotees sometimes appear very wonderful due to the direction of the Lord. Beginning from Brahma, the topmost intelligent living entity within the universe, down to the smallest ant, every living entity's intelligence is overseen by the Lord in his transcendental position as a witness of all actions. The subtle presence of the Lord is felt by the intelligent man who can study the psychic effect of thinking, feeling, and willing. So in this verse in purport, the interaction of the Lord's different energies is described, and we'll try to elaborate on different topics that result in this talk this morning. So three energies of the Supreme Lord and their interaction are described. The Supreme Lord himself, Bhagavan, the Lord's material nature, material energy, and the Lord's marginal potency, the Jiva. So how these three energies of the Lord interact. Well, Prabhupada, in his purport, focuses on the influence that an individual soul, a jiva, can have on the creation in which he or she finds himself. We're seeing it manifest before us right now in the public, in the news. We're seeing the influence of Queen Elizabeth and how she, her life had impact around the world. And I'm not talking about what kind of impact, good or bad or right or wrong, but just the fact that an individual jiva soul is having such impact around the world, the creation in which she finds herself. This is only possible, as Prabhupada describes in the purport, it's only possible by the will of the Lord. It's not like that Queen Elizabeth or any jiva soul is independent and can accomplish anything in this world. Prabhupada makes it very clearly in the purport. When he's talking about Columbus, another mundane personality, but he got some credit as the discoverer of America. Not because he did anything other than, as it describes in the purport, pleased the Lord in some way in his past life, and therefore got the ability to make some impact, to have some influence. The living entity, the point being made is that the living entity is not independent. Now, you know, and I think there's a verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita that describes how Krishna consciousness can't be spread without the special sanction of the Lord. And so when we're thinking about a situation like is in the public view right now, how mundane influence is created, how much more qualified is the, as Prabhupada calls him here, the discoverer, how much more powerful is the discoverer, Srila Prabhupada. If we look at Srila Prabhupada's influence, as an ordinary person, even there's different places you'll find descriptions of famous people who became famous only in the latter part of their lives. Srila Prabhupada's name is on that list. There's that catechization of influence after the age of 70 or something like that. So even in a mundane way, Srila Prabhupada's accomplishments show an influence that can be analyzed as a jiva being empowered by the Lord. All the more so when the empowerment and the result of that empowerment is spreading Krishna consciousness. It's quite amazing when you think about Prabhupada and the influence he had on the material nature. I was reading Our Prabhupada distributed a set of books to Captain Pandya, the captain of the Jaladuta. When they were nearing the end of the voyage, Prabhupada went to the captain and said, "I want you to buy my three sets of books because I don't have any money. We're going to be landing soon in New York. So I'm going to sell these to you for $15. He gave 20. Prabhupada went from that position, walking off the boat, not knowing anyone in New York, not having any facilities awaiting him. He walked off with nothing other than the empowerment of the Supreme Lord. Now that was in September 1965. About 10 years later, in the middle of the summer, same city, New York City, a city that Prabhupada himself called the most important city in the world. And in many ways, it is still today. But little more than 10 years after Prabhupada walked off the Jaladuta gangplank, he was riding down New York's Fifth Avenue, described as the most important street in the most important city of the world. He was riding on a Rath Yatra cart that had previously not been seen outside of Orissa, India. And he was surrounded by devotees from all over the world. By people from all over the world. People who he had made devotees by his influence. Just try to imagine the triumph that was, it is, Srila Prabhupada's pastimes. That he could come to New York City, have to go to the Bowery and live in the Bowery because he had no place to go, a borrowed place in the Bowery, one of the most despicable places in New York City. And in 10 years' time, rise to the point where he's riding with the Lord, the Lordships, Baldev, Jagannath, Subhadra, riding with their lordships in a grand procession down New York's Fifth Avenue. There's hardly a story you'll find of any successful person. Of course, people become wildly successful by the mercy of the Lord. But in such a short period of time, 10 years, at such an age. Clearly we see here the hand of the Lord in his talk last night. Srila Kamaswami was talking about how he was massaging Prabhupada and thinking about how Prabhupada had become so influential and how that influence would increase. And he was like, in his own words, prepping Prabhupada, like as a boxer is prepped by his trainer, to go out there and knock them out. But Prabhupada stopped him. He said, "No." And he said very meekly, "We are simply a servant. We are simply a servant." So he didn't think himself as a big influencer of the world. He kept in perspective. He understood, just like Brahma does here in the verse. Brahma is explaining how he understands that I'm not the creator. You're the creator. I'm just following you, following your order, fulfilling what you have started. He knew that. So similarly, Prabhupada knew that the influence belonged to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's the interaction of the Lord's energies. The jiva may do something very wonderful, but as described in his purport, he or she only does that wonderful act sanctioned by the Supreme Lord. So we should understand and try to see the material nature in this way. Whenever we see anything that's powerful or very influential, it's the mercy of the Lord. The Lord's energy is being facilitated by his servants, the Jivatma. So that's one aspect, or one way in which the Lord's three energies interact. The verse is talking about the process of creation. So, what is the role of the Jivatma in the creation of the Lord? That's one topic that I just want to introduce today. Well, what does Ishapanishad say about the creation of the Lord? Does anybody know?
It's perfect and complete.
Yes. The invocation of Sri Ishapanishad. I love this translation of the verse. The personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, and because he is completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced by the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because he is a complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from him, he remains the complete balance. So, Lord Brahma is telling us in this verse that he realizes that the Lord's creation is already complete. I'm not the source of its completion, the creation, or nor do I have the ability to ensure its complete nature. That is the Supreme Lord's business. Nature is under the full control of God. Our whole purpose, our whole endeavor in this material world is to disprove that. Somehow or another we have to disprove. And we try to disprove that nature can be exploited by us, or should be exploited by us. Even in the name of religion, people say that God gave man dominion over the land, animals. So we can use that to create slaughterhouses which annually kill billions of animals around the world. We can do that. We have sanction. We think. We start taking things under our own control. Prabhupada says in the purport we read that if you do that, then you have to suffer the consequences. The devotees like Brahma and Arjuna do not do anything on their own account, but as fully surrendered souls, They always await indication from the Lord. Therefore they attempt to do something wonderful. Their attempt to do something wonderful appears wonderful to the ordinary vision. One who has another conception that he's the controller has to face the consequences of acting independently. This is one reason why Srila Prabhupada spoke so strongly against the scientists, because the scientists have this idea, this perception of the world, and their idea is to propagate it. Back in the 70s and early 80s, Bhakti Gadad had printed an article that featured an interview with Sataputta Prabhu and Bhakti Subdhamanar Maharaj and Madhava Das. These three were doing the Bhaktivedanta Institute preaching, BI preaching. What's going on right downtown in Gainesville today? And so BTG in the interview asked a question about how the scientists, Jiva, how they perceived, what was their perception of the material energy and of the energy of the Lord. So BTG asked the question, does the theory of evolution do away with the necessity of God or spiritual purpose in the development of nature? Does the theory of evolution do away with the necessity of God or any spiritual purpose in the devotion, in the development of nature? And Sataputta gave a short answer, but it described very clearly what is the position of the loyal Jivatma, surrendered Jivatma, and what's the position of the unsurrendered Jivatma, the one that's trying to do things on their own. So Sataputta Prabhu says, evolutionists justify their view by saying more or less, if it didn't happen our way, we'd be forced to accept a supernatural explanation. And that we refuse to do. That's their best argument. But how did the eye evolve? They say it had to evolve by chance mutations, because otherwise we'd have to suppose divine creation. They have faith in chance, and we have faith in God. That's what it comes down to. They have faith in chance. And we have faith in God. Actually, if I read you a description, which I plan to do, of an experience called a Eureka moment. Are you familiar with this Eureka moment? It's like a moment of enlightenment where a problem that you couldn't solve before, it becomes clear. Oh yes, I understand now, a Eureka moment. Someone's done an analysis of a Eureka moment. And I think that if you hear these four short sentences, you can get some idea of what, how they view it as chance, and also how we view it as faith, because the description actually sounds like the description of faith, someone who has faith. It's very interesting. It's amazing how you can just have a few papers and you can never find what you're looking for. Okay, here it is. Four things that sound like faith to me, because they take it as chance. The first phase of an aha experience requires a problem solver to come upon an impasse where they become stuck, and even though they may seemingly have explored all possibilities, are still unable to solve or achieve a solution. The aha moment appears suddenly. Again, these are the four things that to me sound like a faith experience, but they're taking it as a chance experience. The moment appears suddenly. The solution to a problem can be processed smoothly. In other words, you know how to do it, which you couldn't do before, quite easily. Third, the aha moment elicits a positive effect. Fourth, a person experiencing the aha moment is convinced that a solution is true. So it appears suddenly, the solution is simple, fluent, it's a positive effect, and you're convinced that it's true. Does that sound like faith or chance? To me it sounds like it's talking about chance. I'm talking about faith, not some random thing.
Is it like experimental? Experimental through the process, I came to that conclusion.
Well, just the experience is just, it could be, well, examples are Newton. Newton was sitting under a tree and an apple fell on his head or something. And he all of a sudden understood the nature of the law of gravity. There is a list of many well-known effects, well-known scientific discoveries, which came about like this, like the periodic table of elements.
No, I don't
think. But it's. Yeah, but if you look at these four things, my point is that if you look at these four things, they almost describe like you have a faith experience. That all of a sudden you're chanting your japa and you get you suddenly understand how you're not the body. You can see how that works quite easily. It's positive, and you feel encouraged in devotional service. And you have faith that it's true, that you're experiencing. Those things sound like something that built faith to me, not chance. But the scientists, they take it as chance. And that's their relationship with the material nature, is chance. Someone that's Bhaktivedanta Swami, who was a scientist before he joined, became a devotee. He did a study of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and based on the teachings of our acharyas, he came to the conclusion that Scientists say that material nature is independent, but what they're really saying when they say that is that we can exploit material nature. And this is a key teaching of modern science, or those atheistic jivatmas throughout history. But Bhakti Vedanta Swami says that if we study the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, where there's a description of his creation, we study that very carefully, we can understand how the Bhagavatam is teaching us not to rely on this idea of exploiting material nature. He says that we find a story in the third canto of Hiranyaksha and Lord Varahadev. And there's a battle between the two, which the Bhagavatam is telling us that there's a struggle between an atheistic idea of controlling material nature, like Hiranyaksha wanted to do, and the real use of material energy through the performance of sacrifice, which is represented by Lord Varaha, Varaha avatar being described as containing all the functions, ritualistic functions of offering sacrifice. So it's Vedic sacrifice versus demonic exploitation of material nature. And who wins? No one knows who wins?
Nature always wins.
The Varaha wins. Not the Varaha wins, meaning that trying to atheistically exploit material nature is a losing proposition, whereas if we perform Vedic sacrifice, then that's the proper use, proper interaction of the three energies of the Lord. So those are some thoughts on this verse and purport. Other questions, comments?
I have a comment and a question. Okay. Comment is, you spoke of, from the Bible, people will defend their eating meat by saying that the Lord says, have dominion over the animals. The man should have, or has dominion over the animals. But the word dominion comes from the root domus, which means home. And a home is for protection, not exploitation. That's what I tell people sometimes. Domus. Domus means home, Latin.
Latin.
And, do you have any realizations on this very last sentence of the purport? The subtle presence of the Lord is felt by the intelligent man who can study the psychic effects of thinking, feeling, and willing. I don't know, maybe that word psychic effects got me.
Well, believe it or not, that's what the class is supposed to be about.
What'd you say?
Believe it or not, that's what the class is supposed to be about. Understanding the interactions.
We have 15 minutes.
You mean you didn't get there yet?
No, no.
Well, you did and I missed it.
Yeah, we got there already, at least according to my notes here.
Oh, I missed it, huh? I'm sorry.
No, just the point is that if we study the interaction of the different energies of the Supreme Lord, that is, in effect, using our intelligence to understand the thinking of the materialist versus the thinking of the devotee. thinking, feeling, and willing of a devotee versus thinking, willing, and feeling of an atheistic person. Does that make sense? Yes.
So when Columbus was coming to the West, even though it may seem like a chance thing, but really that was the time of Lord Chaitanya. When Lord Chaitanya was in India preaching, a lot of changes were taking place suddenly in Europe. Suddenly they invented like the printing press, they had better maps, better, you know, better ways to come to the West. You see? So even though for a mundane person it seems like chance and their own endeavor, but really to the input of Lord Chaitanya there were changes throughout the world during his time. You see, a lot of changes took place.
Well, that's the example that you're sort of answering in Bhatmika's question, because material energy, you're understanding how the material energy is working in different ways and preparing or blocking advancement. In other words, there's another hand involved, and that hand is not limited like our hand. We try to do something and the effects are limited, but when the Supreme Lord acts, it has multi-effects.
Yeah,
and so I take what you're saying to mean that all the so-called advancement that was going on in material society at that time was also under the direction of the Supreme Lord. Okay. There's no other place where it could really come from.
Yeah, and the scientists, you know, like you say with Newton and the apple and gravity, they might say Eureka or this and that, but it's the Lord, you know, I mean, giving them all these ideas and everything, but they can't see from that plot.
Just this morning, actually, I was listening to Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj, and he made an interesting point. Are you talking about us trying to, you know, like a scientist, they're trying to figure out the material nature and all that. He said that you can see that when Lord Brahma came, when he appeared, he also had the same, you can see it's coming from him. He also had the same mentality of trying to figure out where did he come from. So he goes through so much endeavor to figure out himself to finally realize that he can't go anywhere that way. And then he performs tapa and then he goes internal. But he was making the point that it's a natural thing that we see that even Lord Brahma did that, is like the scientists do. He was like the first scientist, so to speak, trying to figure out material nature and his origin and stuff like that.
Yeah, unfortunately, the scientists, if we could offer them some credit, they had scientific movement had obviously impact on the world, and so, based on whatever piety they've done in the past, that theory has grown and become influential, which we understand is only possible by the Supreme Lord. But as long as it remains atheistic, then it's not going to be ultimately beneficial. Prabhupada says, what is the ultimate benefit of scientific advancement? What have they taken us to?
Hell.
He says the atom bomb. It's taken us to destruction, not anything constructive.
Another point he was making was that yes, there's material advancement or whatever, but actually because of the scientists, the consciousness is degraded. So that's what the scientists, ungodly scientists are doing, is actually degrading our consciousness. I thought that was a very interesting point. Is making is the consciousness of the living entity is going down.
Well, that's in line with what Prabhupada did. Prabhupada did not just stop at the point of criticizing the scientists and calling them demons and everything like that, but he wanted to give them Krishna consciousness. So he expended quite an amount of resources. He told the BDT, give Srila Dharmadhar $10,000 per month. That was back in the 70s. Because he wanted to explore this idea of the scientists, engage with it, not just condemn it. And that, as I said, is still going on today. The BI devotees are hard at working at engaging, not condemning and fighting, but engaging with them. That's a platform of a preacher.
So we can conclude that, is it that Srila Prabhupada was not against the scientists per se, but against atheistic scientists, yeah?
Yeah, well, if you read his books, how much is described there in scientific terms? He uses vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You probably find something in today's purport, or translation of purport words, as a scientific bent to it.
Causation philosophy. But causation philosophy also agrees there is a cause.
But it's your mouth. Back on you.
So how does by chance and causation philosophy interact in between? I mean, it like contradicts me. Maybe I'm not understanding that.
Well, the causation goes back to the cause of all causes.
Correct.
And if you're not willing to go to investigate till you come to the ultimate cause, then how sincere are you about ultimately finding your cause of things? So it requires engagement. If the scientists want to engage in a causal analysis, and I need to be willing to engage with causes which are claimed to be, and can be supported to be, beyond the cause that they accept. Like Sataputra said, it comes down to this, that's what it comes down to. It's evolved, they have faith in chance and they have faith in God, that's what it comes down to. So those two things have to meet. And causation is a way that it can be analyzed.
Mm. When the scientists are bent on explaining all causes through the laws of physics.
Yeah.
So you're bent on doing that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. If they come to that position, they're not willing to engage any further in causes beyond what they can analyze, then that's irrational.
But if you think very deeply, like most of the scientists, they just say what is what, why, or how. But they cannot say what's the purpose. I never see that, I never hear. What's the purpose of life, or purpose of anything that happens?
As I was explaining, in Bhaktivedanta Swami Sannyasa, the third canto, Aranyaksha, the purpose is to enjoy. And the material nature and the ways of exploring it are justification enough for doing this. Someone else?
Hare Krishna. Is this on? Oh. Thank you for class. You made the point that if a living entity does something of great influence, it was because he or she pleased the Lord in their previous lifetime. My understanding was that if someone has a great ability, it's due to their good karma. So is this a combination of both, or can you please explain this to me?
Well, good karma comes from pleasing the Lord. In other words, if someone is exhibiting the results of influence, wealth, fame, these things are due to past good karmas, and they're getting the fruit of their karma. Does that make sense?
It does. I guess I was just thinking, if our actions are purely on a mundane platform and they produce good karma, I didn't see that as pleasing the Lord, but the Lord is pleased nonetheless.
Well, the Lord has made an arrangement that pleases, to please Him. So even if we're following the material, like the Varnashram system, for instance, that's not in itself leading to God realization. But it's something created by the Lord Himself that gives one a chance to gradually progress towards actual God realization. Now, along the way, that progress includes performing pious activities, good deeds, which result in opulences, wealth, fame, knowledge, renunciation, these things. And so when we see those displayed, we can understand that people have been following the Lord's instructions, maybe at a lower level, but has been following them and therefore accumulating good karma. So we see that in their lives. Many influential people decry God, but they only got in a position where they could decry God and influence others by past pious activities. So piety is not necessarily equal to God consciousness, because the results of piety stay within this material realm. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it makes sense. Thank you.
Anything else? Come to Ashimad Bhagavatam, can you tell me?
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Very nice class.